How You Entrepreneurs. Today we have Dr. Grace Lee. So she has a PhD in neuroscience. She's also a coach where she assists people from the schooling to real world. So she'll kind of walk them through, help them get to that next level. Her story is one of the really interesting ones. She basically came from someone living on the streets at the age of 10 to getting her PhD in neuroscience. You're going to want to listen to this. You're going to want to subscribe and, of course, tell your friends. This is a great one. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to the Road to Growth, Success of an Entrepreneur.
We've raised the bar.
Learn firsthand from successful business owners and create your own path to success.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
It's time to hit the road to growth with real estate agent Vinny SD.
So we are here with Dr. Grace Lee, brain behavior expert, PhD in neuroscience. You are an impressive woman. So tell me a little about yourself.
Yes, I graduated with a PhD in neuroscience, and it was here in Vancouver, Canada, because it was my dream city to come to. I travel a lot. I've been to a lot of cities around the world, and Vancouver just caught my eye, and I told myself, someday I want to buy a home and settle here. So my plan, my game plan was to ultimately do my PhD here and then just stay here. So I made that happen. But prior to moving to Vancouver, I lived in Edinburgh, Scotland, because that was where I did my master's degree. So it was.
Did you ever have haggis?
Yes, absolutely. It's great.
To ask. I've never had it. I've been to Scotland a couple of times, but I've never had it. So I haven't been that adventurous yet. So why Canada? Why Vancouver?
I visited one time in junior high around grade 5 or 6. I can't remember which grade, but I came to Vancouver and it was my first time coming to Vancouver. And I just fell in love with the city. I remembered it as a city that impressed me, you know, and I just kept remembering it and wanting to settle there one day.
Nice. So tell me about what you do.
Currently, I run my own business. So I have a business where I help professionals, you know, career-driven professionals to up-level their career, their business, and their life. In a nutshell, that is what I do. And so they end up creating lives of inspiring lives and fulfilling lives.
Okay, so how did you come from the PhD in neuroscience to basically uplifting lives, helping people grow as individuals? There has to be some kind of backstory.
There does, because it doesn't seem very logical, right?
Well, you know what? I've learned to basically everything can be logical if you look at it the right way.
I love that statement. It is so true. Because the expectation of someone with a PhD is they either go the professorial route, and the epitome of success there is a tenure track professorial, or their faculty or their instructors or science communication, something like that, right? So those are more the traditional routes. And it wasn't that I decided that I planned in advance that I would start a business and help professionals this way. It was more of a need that I saw and I experienced. You see, I was 10 years in the academic world, from bachelor's, master's, PhD, a total of 10 years. So that's a long enough time to really understand that world and that culture. And if there's anything about that you need to know about academia, is that it's great if you want to learn and immerse yourself in a subject matter expertise. So they teach you all the historic knowledge, the technical knowledge, and it organizes very well in a curriculum. Right. And so you have that knowledge, and the subject matter depends on the major that you choose or the focus that you choose. Right. So the education system is great at teaching you these things. But there's a gap in the education system. They don't teach you how to take this knowledge you've collected. I call them like data points. You're collecting data all these years in your degree, and they don't teach you how to take that information, how to package it, how to organize it, and deliver it into invaluable wisdom to exchange for money. Right, fair exchange for money in the marketplace. So they don't teach you how to make money. And they also don't teach you how to answer the more important questions in life, like who am I and what's important to me, right? And how to build a career. And so I felt this gap, and I saw a lot of very highly educated, highly skilled individuals burned by the system. And they just were stuck in the system, didn't want to leave the academic world. And it wasn't relevant in today's job market realities. The context is not there. And so students, they go through so many years of school and they think about their careers very linearly, right? And there's the and the thing about a career is that it's not like in the traditional past where it's one long, you know, 30, 40, you know, maybe even 50 year long tunnel. Today's careers are so different. They're like micro careers, project based, you know, strategic alliances are extremely important. And the education system traditionally was created in the 1940s and 50s. And it just doesn't, it doesn't keep up with today's job market realities. And so I saw this gap and people not being taught these things. And I decided to fill the void. I wanted to fill the gap of the education system. And I started teaching, right? This was during my PhD. I started teaching these principles of career development. I started teaching things like, well, how do you think of important questions like that? I started partnering with other people to teach financial literacy, things that the education system doesn't teach you. How do you manage money? How do you get out of debt? How do you plan your estates and your will and things like that? All money management. And every time I held a seminar or a workshop or taught something in a classroom, I noticed how there was such a need for it. The classroom would be filled to the back and people standing in the back, right? Fire hazard. And so I saw this need. And it was then that I stepped into my role as a mentor, a career mentor and a career educator.
So I have a couple questions. So you got your degree in Scotland, Craig said?
The master's degree, yes.
Master's degree. And then where did you go to school before that?
My bachelor's was also in Vancouver. That was okay. Another reason how I tasted what it's like to live here.
So for, and I'm out in California, San Diego, in the United States. And so we have a more general education, even in college, basically the first 2 years is basically general education. Then you get more specialized as you go forward. In Vancouver, is it more specialized at a young, because I know in Europe, it's more specialized at a younger age. Is that the case there or not the case?
No, it's not the case.
Okay, so it's more general still, kind of similar to the United States?
When you out of high school, you start your bachelor's degree, you choose a faculty, you know, okay. And the two biggest ones are science or arts faculty, and then there's engineering, right? Applied science. And the first and second year of your degree, it's general. They have a curriculum where you have to take your electives, right? And then you choose your academic major, preferably after the second year. Right? So it's focused on breadth.
So with that kind of, so the reason why I ask you about that, if you're talking about the way that it's currently structured, right? The schooling system is currently structured. Mm-hmm. It's more of a kind of an archaic mindset of how work used to be, right? Now, have you ever thought about if you could revamp the whole schooling system, how you would do it?
Yeah, definitely I have. And it's interesting because after a PhD, I went on to do a postdoctoral fellowship. Right, because this is me back then, not knowing how to navigate my own career. I'm trying to figure things out on my own too. So I did a postdoctoral fellowship, and that was when I really started on this career education and career mentorship journey. Right, my PhD, I was kind of feeling things out, and now I'm in my PhD. I'm definitely more familiar with the academic world and the scary bridge to get out into the real world and start making money. Right, so I'm more familiar with that. And during my PhD, there was a program that was initiated from the graduate students office. And it was called Reimagining the PhD, right? And these were the heads of departments from top universities in North America that came to Vancouver, and I'm from the University of British Columbia, that's my alma mater. So they came there, they gathered at the department head, and they were discussing how we need to reimagine the PhD to fit better within the global context of careers and job market realities. So they had this discussion with all the heads of department, and I was one of the only students that was invited because of my prominence, you know, in the community. You know, I was president of a postdoctoral association at the time, and I used my name to get out there and to get the message out there that we need to be more proactive and empowered at defining our own career and our destinies. So they invited me there, and it was an amazing discussion. You know, professors, heads of departments are actually aware of how the PhD program does and does not prepare students for a future, you know, for a career. So they brainstormed. It was a very high level brainstorming, like a masterminding on how we can change the program, how we can introduce elements into it. In the long run though, this was like, I would say in 2013, 2012 or 2013, that's when it happened. And you see, just like the corporate environment, when you make a decision, it takes so long to take effect, right? And this is what we're seeing is that it's, the change takes so long to make, right? So if it were me, and these were some ideas that I gave, you know, that I gave into that meeting, I would say that students should be encouraged to form partnerships and networks and contacts with individuals outside of the academic world, and that the conversation has to be changed, you know, because when you are in a PhD program or even a master's program in graduate studies, the expectation is that you will follow the footsteps of your supervisor, that you will stay in a faculty position, you know, become a professor, and that's like the epitome of success, or you use your degree the way it was intended. And so that conversation, although it's not explicitly stated, it's still there. And so students don't feel free to explore other options. And there's this term called alternative careers. You know, and it's kind of like saying professor is the default and everything else is an alternative. You see what I mean? So this creates a culture where...
Negative connotation almost.
Exactly. So this creates a culture where highly skilled, highly intelligent individuals don't feel empowered to explore because they feel like, well, I'd be a failure if I didn't use the degree the way I was intended. And I was caught up in that too. You know, I was, and then the sunken cost fallacy and all that. And it just creates disempowerment and people who, you know, they're not encouraged. So they don't have the courage to go and explore what's valuable.
So where did you get your courage from? Where did you get your courage from to actually go on?
Well, that's the thing. The best source to get courage is from within. That's the best source, right? Being intrinsically motivated rather than extrinsically motivated. And what do I mean by that? Right? Extrinsic motivation, it's usually around money and security. Right? All these things around, all this talk about job security that came in the 1940s and 50s during like that industrial age, all that talk about job security, I mean, it's an illusion now. Job security is an illusion, and yet we still desire it. Because as humans, we want to have certainty and predictability. But what we don't realize is that job security and those desires for extrinsic motivation, they're driven by fear, right? They're driven by fear. You know, you fear loss, or you feel failure. So you want security and predictability, right? But that my message, you know, this is the message that I always put out there. My message is job security does not exist. And it's actually the foundation of job security is fear. Instead, we need to pursue what I call vocational confidence. Right? Vocation, if you think about it, is higher than a career. A career is aligned with your lifestyle and making a living. All of that is your career. It's meaningful and it's very ambitious for ambitious people. But your vocation is a true calling. It aligns with your personal and professional mission. So that's a vocation. And if it's vocational confidence, that phrase means that you can have career setbacks, but it's knowing that you can reinvent yourself and you can always move ahead in your career no matter what's happening outside of you, right? If you focus on job security, you're at the will of the economy or availability of job postings or, right? And that's outside of your control. You're outside of your control. And that's the focus in job security. But focusing on vocational confidence, it's intrinsic motivation. It's the foundation is empowerment, you know, not fear. And it's driven by knowing that self-education is where it's at. You know, it's not necessarily go to school, get good grades, and then get a good job.
Well, so you have such a strong focus on this mission right here.
Yeah.
I'm assuming at a young age, you didn't have this focus, you know, you weren't born with it. So can you walk me through kind of, you're an orphan, correct? And kind of what happened next?
Yeah. And here's the thing. I mean, you must be familiar with Tony Robbins' quote of, if you want to take the island, you got to burn the boats, right?
Yeah.
Right. Because people who are in a do or die situation tend to succeed. And my childhood was a do or die situation. And what happened was when I was 8 years old, my family was involved in a car accident. And it was my mom was driving. My father was in the passenger seat. My brother and I were in the back seat. And back then, there's not a whole lot of education. So my brother and I did not have our seatbelts on. Right? My parents, because it was late and they wanted us to catch up on it was past our bedtime. So they put down, you know, how you can move down the back seat.
Yeah.
It was a hatchback. So they moved down the hatch of the back seat and they kind of laid some towels for us to sleep on like it was a bed. Wow. And that's how we were driving. And it was a head-on collision. Of course, we flew everywhere. And the car was completely destroyed. And so in that car accident, my mom was driving. She had a severe brain trauma. And from what I hear, I don't know the details, but she was in a coma and she didn't survive. She passed away from that and I never got to see her. And so that's what subconsciously seeded my interest in neuroscience, her brain trauma, my own injuries as well. I had a high cervical dislocation. There was some fracturing there as well. I didn't have a spinal cord injury. That's why I'm able to move and have full use of my limbs today. But I was very close to becoming a quadriplegic, very close. And my recovery was very long, the rehabilitation, learning to walk again because of my atrophy. It took a long time. So that, both of them, you know, my spine and my mother's head trauma, it seeded my interest in neuroscience. And I didn't realize it until later. But what happened after the car accident and the recovery was that, well, my father, he remarried and he had a couple of daughters from the new marriage. And around that time of him, you know, birthing, you know, having introducing his daughters into the world, he came into my bedroom and he basically told me that he was not able to care for me and that I needed to find an alternative.
How old are you?
10.
Wow.
Yeah. And I needed to find an alternate caregiving situation. And so I left, you know, I had to go and he didn't want to continue the relationship with me as well. And so I left.
What happened to your brother?
He was around. Yeah, he was around. And it was just me that he said that to.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was just me. And he's my older brother, right? Yeah. It was just me that he said that to. And so I did leave. I didn't find an alternative, right? And so there's what began my orphaned years. And it was a very strange and very dark, the darkest years of my life, because I spent so many nights there out on the street roaming and just feeling hopeless and alone and suicidal and just feeling worthless. The worst part of it all was that I wasn't angry at him. It was more like feeling, you know, of course this happened because I'm not worthy of being loved because I have no value as a human. And that's how I internalized the whole situation. And, you know, fast forward 4 years of this, you know, until when I was 14, I serendipitously met an older couple. I was working at a restaurant at the time.
Let me interrupt you 1 second. Sorry. For anyone that's not watching the video of this and just listening to it, Dr. Grace is smiling with all this heartache. I'm like listening right now. I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is the worst. And she's smiling. So very positive individual right here. All right. Sorry.
I can say this now more than 20 years later, you know, but at that time, I definitely wasn't smiling.
Yeah.
Definitely not. I have gratitude now for all that I've been through because I know why it happened. But back then I had no idea. And all I can think about was, you know what? I could die right now and no one would know and no one would care. That's all I thought every day during those dark years. Yeah. Right. And so things turned around when I met that couple when I was 14 working at the restaurant. And they were very astute. They noticed, you know, they observed and they basically said to me after they had their meal, they settled their bill and they said to me, Grace, you need a place to stay. Why don't you come and live with us?
Oh my gosh.
Complete strangers. So I followed them home. Very risky, very risky. But I was desperate. And when you're desperate and survival mode, you do certain things. And I followed them home. So there, I followed them home, carrying everything I owned in a backpack. And there they led me to their house, which was a very humble wooden yellow house. Entered the front door through the kitchen. And then there was a narrow staircase, carpeted staircase, up the staircase to the right. And there was a huge bedroom with yellow walls, slanted ceiling, and the biggest bed I've ever seen. They turned to me. We're standing in this in the bedroom on their hardwood floors. They turned to me and they say, Grace, welcome home. You can stay here for as long as you need. Treat this as your house, you know, and they're saying these things to me and it was not computing. It wasn't computing. All I can think of was, oh my gosh, okay, I have a place to stay. But I didn't trust them. right? I thought that I still need to stay on my toes because I don't know how long I'm able to stay here. I'm allowed to stay here.
Yeah. So
I didn't trust them. I didn't develop a relationship with them. I kept them at an arm's length, you know, and this happened for 2 years. I did this testing and not trusting for 2 years until I was 16. And that was when I had my awakening moment. And I heard his voice for the first time, the husband's voice for the first time. And when you hear, it's not about hearing their voice, it's hearing their voice. If you know what I mean, if you hear my tonality, I heard his voice. And that was when I realized they are the real deal. They're sincere. They meant what they said. I can stay here for as long as I need.
Did you ever find out why they brought you in? Why they chose you? Why they even chose anyone?
I did. I did find out. I found out later, and it's simple. Their reason is because they saw a child with a need, and they could fill the need. That's it.
Wow.
That's it. And it was truly, truly that simple. Wow. And prior to meeting me, they never encountered a child with a need. So I was their first orphan. And now I should say, and I'll do a plug-in for them, fast forward years later, now they are citizens of Uganda.
Wow.
And they have an orphanage there. They started an orphanage 20 years ago. Hundreds of children are provided for and cared for and loved because of my parents.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did throughout this process, did your biological father ever reach out, ever come back in the picture, anything like that?
No, he did not.
What about your brother, older brother?
It was distance after that. After high school, like that, it was distanced, and we had it already put a distance between us.
Yeah.
And there were decades where there was no contact, nothing like that. But recently, he did reach out. He did reach out. He came to Vancouver. He flew to Vancouver, and I think he lives in Ontario somewhere. I don't remember where, but he lives in Ontario. He flew to Vancouver, and he reached out on Facebook. You know, Facebook has this way of reuniting people. So he reached out on Facebook. It's a very casual, a casual message. And we met for lunch. And I met him and his wife and his kids. Yeah, I met his kids. You know, it was the first time. And it was great. But I can't say that we're particularly close or anything.
Do you have any resentment towards him?
No, I never had. That's the thing. I never had resentment towards my relatives. The way I internalized it was not resentment or anger. It was on me that I'm not worthy.
So when did you feel that find out, or what process did you go through to realize that you are worthy?
It was a long process, but my parents, and I call them my parents now because basically they're my mom and dad, right? Yeah. So my parents really helped in that process. But it wouldn't have happened if I didn't have that moment where I realized they were sincere. It was that moment that changed my life. Well, first when they gave me a second chance, and now I'm no longer in survival mode.
Yeah.
That was, but I didn't realize it until I was 16. I still kept that survival mode mentality until I was 16. When I could finally let go of that, that was magical, because now my brain, I have the mental capacity to think about other things. Before that, when I didn't trust them, you know, I was so worried that they're gonna kick me out, or they're gonna ask me to leave, or they're just gonna get tired of me because I'm so unworthy of being loved. One day they're gonna ask me to leave. So I had this survival energy, you know, that, you know, I'm on the bottom here. I still have to stay on my toes. And so it was contraction, right? That didn't allow me to focus on anything else except survive. So when I let go of that, finally, truly let go of that, all of a sudden, I no longer want to give up on life. I stopped giving up on life. I stopped saying that it's worthless. I don't have a future. All of a sudden, my conversation became, I want to have a future. I want to have a better life. I want to be independent so I don't end up in a situation like this. It was empowering, but I didn't know how I was going to do it because nobody was paying for my education. No one was going, there was no allowance, there was no support that way. So I had to be resourceful. And that's what I mean, my do or die. It was like, this is do or die. If I don't find a way to pay for my college education, then I'm going to die. So, just do or die.
So there's this idea that I always look at that people go away from fear, right? Instead of going towards pleasure, yes. Right? So with yourself and in these moments of building out your business, do that kind of thing, do you ever have to go back to that time when you were 14 and remember who that person was and push away from it? Is it more towards kind of who you're going to be in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's so true what you just said, that most people would do more to avoid pain than to move towards pleasure. That's the human psychology of it. I look at the pattern of the way I operated ever since an early age. I was always the other one moving towards
A
better future. I was always the moving towards person. It's just how I'm wired. It's just how I behave. And so my incentive is more on the reward and more on the fulfillment than it is to avoid pain, because I was so used to pain. If you think about it, at such a young age, I was so used to it. I dwelled in it every second, every minute, every hour. I didn't handle it well. You know, as a 10-year-old child, I didn't handle it well, and I didn't handle it in a mature way. But I was so used to it that I was numb to it, you know. But, you know, of course, you start a business, and when you start a business, there's a lot of challenges. And there are moments where I know that the average business does not go past beyond 1 year. And so there's thoughts of, well, if I don't make it, I don't want to end up not being able to provide, not, you know, losing the house, things like that. Thoughts come like that, right? But it's a matter of catching them when they do come and realizing the truth of what I have accomplished.
So how do you overcome those moments? Those moments of saying, I don't want this to happen, and then kind of catch yourself. What do you do to kind of get past them and catch yourself?
It's recognizing, okay, I am thinking like this now. These thoughts did appear in my mind. And it's about leaning on the truth of what I did accomplish in my life. Basically, you look for evidence. Look for evidence of how you did overcome things in the past. Look for evidence of how you did make something happen. And I did. I was resourceful. I brought in money out of nowhere that paid for my entire education.
Wow.
And I had nothing in my name, nothing under my name. And I was able to fund my entire 10-year college without any parental support.
So if you could take the moment right now to kind of look at that younger self, that one that got let go by her father or biological father, what kind of advice would you give that person?
You mean advice to my younger self, right?
Yeah, younger self, yeah.
You know, at that time, as a 10-year-old Grace, feeling unwanted and abandoned and feeling worthless, I wasn't looking for advice. I just wanted someone to come by my side, hold my hand, and tell me it's going to be okay. That's all I wanted. Advice at that time would not have been received. I just wasn't in the right state of mind. And that's the thing. We human beings, we always want to fix things, because fixing things, solving a problem, it does two things. First, it fulfills our purpose, so we feel good about it. It gives us purpose and fulfills it, so we feel good about it. And secondly, we are able to solve someone else. So the vision of their problem being solved through us is rewarding as well. And we feel we've made an important contribution. But here's the thing. Sometimes the situation doesn't call for you to be the problem solver. Sometimes it is for you to be practicing active listening and to be an active participant. And we're so caught in that. And that is the reason why sometimes relationships dissolve and relationships fall apart. It's because we're always trying to solve and solve and solve. But they're not a project. They're not your project. They're not, you know what I mean?
One of my coaches, he actually told me that you're saying right there. I thought it was, because what you're saying, if I would have heard that maybe a year ago, I'd be like, okay, that makes sense. And that's what he exactly told me. He was like, he talks to his wife when his wife's complaining a little bit. And he goes, okay, you want me to help solve the problem, or you just want me to listen? And then she'll tell him this, and then he goes, okay, I'm just listening. Like, but yeah, so no, it's so true. It's hard to do something, because we're wired to like solve the problem, and we're thinking we're helping them out. Like, so I totally agree, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not just because of that reason, but also if you're always solving, if someone is so used to other people helping them solve the problem all the time, it's actually more disabling than enabling. Right, because then they don't have that experience of solving the problem for themselves.
So what's next for Dr. Grace, Dr. Grace Lee? What's next for you? What's next for your company? what's the future hold?
Yeah, for me, this is more than just a business, more than a company. It is something bigger than myself. And I like to refer to it as a global movement, right? I call it career revisionist. And I see it as, you know, around the world, and my ultimate dream is 1 million people impacted, 1 million lives changed by up-leveling their career and up-leveling their life. So that's where I see this going. And it's, you know, it's empowerment. It is these teaching and training. You know, I provide education in a way that the school systems don't teach you on a mass scale, on a bigger scale. And so this is generational work here. You up-level their life, you change your life. It takes one individual. They take that into their family and they pass it on to their children. They are examples and leaders in their children. And it's generational. It keeps going on. The legacy that they build passes on to their children. I've seen this happen on a micro level. And I think that when this global movement expands, then that's truly when we can affect the world.
So if someone's listening right now and they want to be part of this movement, they want to basically learn how to grow, become better, so on and so forth, what's the best way of them finding more information?
My website is named after the movement, so careerrevisionist.com. And also they can contact me on LinkedIn. I'm very active there. Dr. Grace Lee Vancouver or Dr. Grace Lee Neuroscience, you know, my LinkedIn. Connect with me there as well and definitely be happy to connect.
Thank you for being on the podcast. You mean so much great tidbits right there. I mean, it's impressive where you came from, and I mean, you could use those faults in your life right there to say, this is why I'm not where I want to be, but you kind of use them as a stepping stone and kind of just fought. It's impressive, but simple as that. So again, everyone listening, please subscribe, follow Dr. Grace Lee, meet her on LinkedIn, and thanks again.
Thank you, Vinny. It was great. And to your listeners, you know, on the other side of fear is everything you could possibly want in life.
Perfect. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Growth, Success of an Entrepreneur. Please like, subscribe, and stay connected. Visit www.vinnysd.com.
Yeah, I created a website.
Hope to see you again next week. Team Vinny SD, signing off.